Case is submitted. We'll move to case number two, Town of Pine Hill versus 3M, 25-10746. All right, I got Mr. Clement here for the appellant, Ms. Gross here for the appellee. Mr. Clement, looks like you've reserved 3 minutes. Very well.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Paul Clement for appellant 3M. If Pine Hill had simply sued 3M for PFAS remediation of the town's water supply, the appropriateness of a federal forum would be obvious. A federal court could consider all the potential sources of PFAS contamination, including contributions from the International Paper Mill at Prattville and the nearby Maxwell Air Force Base. As to the latter facility and the AFFF-based PFAS from that facility, the federal court could consider whether that activity is protected by a federal defense, and if so, how that defense affects the rest of the case. For example, the federal court could determine whether PFAS associated with the federal activity could be separated from PFAS associated with more commercial activities, and if so, what percentage of the PFAS is shielded by the federal defense. Now, Pine Hill believes that it can avoid all that and a federal forum by disclaiming liability for all AFFF PFAS in its complaint. But as multiple circuits have now concluded, that kind of artificial disclaimer cannot defeat federal jurisdiction in this context. The reality is that given 3M's plausible allegations in its petitions for removal, AFFF and non-AFFF PFAS.
Well, not all of the circuits now. The Seventh Circuit found a disclaimer in that case, which seems to be pretty similar to the disclaimer in this case, was sufficient.
Well, we don't read it that way, Your Honor. We think Raul is a very supportive case for us, and we think that was a very specific kind of disclaimer there. The kind of parties in various cases have referred to that as the not one morsel disclaimer.
How's the disclaimer different? Because the disclaimer here, Pine Hill says, we disclaim any injury resulting from AFFF altogether. Isn't that what we had in the Seventh Circuit?
No, we didn't. What we had in the Seventh Circuit is we had in the initial complaint something that looked a lot like the disclaimer here. And then at oral argument, there was sort of this dramatic moment where counsel for Illinois said, we're willing to stipulate not one morsel, such that if you could prove that one morsel of AFFF PFAS reached our water supply, then we'll give up the whole case. They were so confident. And my friends have had sort of the benefit of that Raul decision and that disclaimer there throughout this litigation, and at no point have they offered to make that kind of not one morsel disclaimer. Now, I want to be clear, and we have a footnote in the brief that makes this clear, that we don't think that would be good enough, but we don't have that in this case.
In the First Circuit, in Maine versus 3M, you were asked by, it was either Judge Montecalvo or Judge Lynch, if you could think of a circumstance where a disclaimer would prevail over the removing defendant's theory of the case, and I thought you responded that it would be the type of a disclaimer that we have in this case, which would be a non-circular disclaimer where the town completely disavows any injury with regard to AFFF. That's what we have in this case. Well, isn't that how you responded to the judge in the First Circuit?
With all due respect, no, Your Honor. I mean, I'd already briefed this case by the time I argued that case in the First Circuit, and I'm quite sure I did not give away this appeal in my answer to, I think it might have been Judge Lynch. So, as I say, as these cases have evolved, there is a pretty clear distinction, certainly in the minds of, I think, the lawyers on both sides, that there is a difference between the general disclaimer of AFFF liability, which everybody has tried, and the kind of not one.
What type of disclaimer would be sufficient then?
Well, I personally don't, and it's been our consistent position throughout, that no disclaimer is sufficient. But if you want to try to at least align yourself with the Raul case in the Seventh Circuit, then what you need is that kind of dramatic, not one morsel disclaimer, which means you lose the case if we can show that even one drop of PFAS involving AFFF reached the town's water supply. And I think, I'm not going to speak for my friend on the other side, but I think there's a very good reason they've been on notice for years.
Aren't they disclaiming, though, that even if it's one morsel, we're not asking for any injury resulting from that one morsel?
Yeah, but it was different in the Raul case where they said if there's one morsel, like, we'll give up the whole case. And the problem is if you say, well, like, we're going to give up any liability from the AFFF, I mean, that's what everybody has done. And the reason that's not sufficient is because that leaves the question, like the $64,000 question about how do you allocate liability between the contamination that's protected by a federal defense and the contamination that's not. And what the Maine court and what the Fourth Circuit in the Maryland case have both said is that question is really just a question about the scope of the federal defense, and that question has to be adjudicated by a federal court. And so that's why there is this critical distinction. I mean, and again, I want to be as clear as I can be, so, in the next case I don't get said in your answer to Judge Wilson's question, you gave something away. But we don't think even a not one morsel disclaimer gets it done, because then you still have this debate about not one morsel, which is still ultimately a question about the scope of the federal defense. But that said, that kind of dramatic disclaimer has only been made in that one case. And I think the reason for it is, revealing, which is I don't think my friends, I mean, given the proximity between the Prattville Mill and Maxwell Air Force Base, I don't think they want to take the position that we lose our whole case if 3M can show that one morsel made it down to Pine Hill. That would be, I think a foolhardy disclaimer in this case for them to do it, which I think, like I said, I obviously have no idea what I'm going to hear next, but they've been on notice from the Raul case for like something like 2 years now. So it'd be pretty astonishing, having had the opportunity to make that disclaimer for over 2 years, to make it at this point. And again, to repeat myself, even if they did, I would still say that's insufficient here.
Can I ask you to address, I don't know if it's Plaquemines or Plaquemines, you probably know better than me.
I try to avoid getting into that debate. I think it's Plaquemines.
But just address the significance of that case for this. I guess that maybe one difference I see is that in Plaquemines, it seems like the relationship was what I've conceived of as vertical, like from production to refining. And here it's sort of horizontal, like sort of like two sources to the same injury or something. But does the rationale of Plaquemines and sort of the loosening of the causation standard apply just the same?
I think it does, Your Honor. Now, the way I've thought about this is I don't think we needed the Chevron case to win this case. And, I think that's sort of, consistent with the fact that the First Circuit decided its case without waiting for the Supreme Court to decide Chevron. The Second Circuit in the Connecticut case, I think, as I infer from the timeline, that they've actually waited for the Chevron decision. And that's a decision that's, fully briefed and argued in the Second Circuit. So we may get that before too long. But what I would say is, I don't think we needed Chevron or Plaquemines to prevail here, but I think it does make it easier. And I think it makes it easier on a couple of fronts, and we surveyed some of this in our letter brief that at the court's request. But I think, for starters, I think the Chevron decision makes clear that to the extent this court continued to apply a causal nexus test, that is no longer the test. It's really a related to test and associated with test, really something more like you have in the ERISA context. So right there, I think that eases our burden quite a bit. As we pointed out in the letter, my friends distinguished the First Circuit Maine case in part on the ground that that the First Circuit applied a more lax standard of related to. So I don't think that distinction works any longer after the intervening Chevron case. I also think that the Chevron case kind of puts the nail in the coffin of any argument that in an acting under case, that it matters whether the federal officer you acted under or the federal agency you acted under is still extant. So I think that kind of underbrush, if you will, is cleared out by the Chevron case. And then I also think the Chevron case, you know, one of the things the magistrate judge did, and then that was obviously approved by the district court, was to really use this notion of the heart of the complaint or the gravamen of the complaint to sort of narrow things substantially. And I don't think that works in the wake of Chevron either. And I don't think that means you have to reconsider the Meadows case. I think the Meadows court was dealing with a very distinct situation, which is a criminal removal of a conspiracy charge.
Why is that different? I mean, we've got an opinion by the chief judge of our circuit, and it's pretty clear in the 11th Circuit now that you can't use this statute, the federal officer removal statute, based on your former conduct. How long has it been since 3M supplied AFFF to the military? It's been over 16 years, long before the facts giving rise to this case, right?
That's right, Your Honor. But you know, that's about 50 years, you know, more recent than the Plaquemines case, where the whole agency, the Petroleum for War Administration, was shut down in 1946. And the way I would, you know, respectfully submit,
what do we do? We disregard our decision in Meadows?
No, I would never ask you to do that, Your Honor. What I would say is it's that decision doesn't apply in an acting under case, is what I would tell you. And I think that's actually necessary to make the Meadows decision consistent with the rule of orderly proceeding, because the Caver case, which came first in this circuit, said that what matters is whether you are acting under a federal officer at the time of the conduct complained on. So that doesn't focus on whether you are currently a federal officer at the time of the complaint. And so the way I would think about it is, like, Meadows sets the rule when you are suing the federal officer directly, but Caver sets the rule for acting under. I mean, you know, look, I think that's the best way to do it without sort of trying to suggest that Chevron overruled Meadows even on its facts. But I think as to acting under, it's clear that you don't have to be acting under at the time that the complaint was filed. And if you'll indulge me for a little bit of detail here, if you actually look at the Meadows decision, one of the critical things that the panel relied on was the difference textually between 1442A and 1442B, and drew a negative inference from that. And 1442B is limited to cases directly against an officer. There's no acting under parenthetical in 1442B. So that gives you a textual reason, as well as a circuit precedent reason, to say that Caver is the rule for acting under, and Meadows is the rule when the federal officer is sued directly.
Can I ask you one question before your opening time runs out? So one thing the other side says about the plausible allegations in your notice of removal is that there are a couple of differences between, I guess, this case and the Fourth Circuit case, which seems to me the closest otherwise. One is that there's no specific allegation, I guess, that 3M supplied the PFAS, and two, that there's no specific allegation that the groundwater leached into the river. What do we do with that, if anything?
So nothing, Your Honor, in the sense that, I mean, I don't think there really are material differences, and to the extent they are, I think it's partially because of the way that the state pled the case in Maryland, so it just kind of, it wasn't all about sort of one town's water supply, it was more statewide, and so I think that caused both the complaint and the petition for removal to be kind of worded a little bit differently, and, you know, it may be that, like, our petition for removal isn't quite as, like, all in one sentence this and all in one sentence that. But I think if you look at, you know, paragraphs 2, paragraphs 4, 24 through 29, 33, 36, 44, those are the relevant paragraphs of the removal petition. It's pretty clear that we are saying that 3M manufactured AFFF PFAS is as plausibly in the town's water supply as, you know, any other source of it. And the one thing just kind of, you know, contextually to keep in mind is, you know, the defendant in a removal case has 30 days to file that petition. And some of the specificity that my friends want is something that would be really hard to get in that sort of 30-day period. And so I think, you know, as with a complaint where, you know, you don't sort of pour out the whole complaint just because, well, you could have been a little more specific, I think the same thing applies for a petition for removal. And the last thing I'll say before I sit down is, you know, we're not hiding a ball here or anything. I mean, there's actually subsequent discovery disclosures in the MDL case, where it's specific that there were both purchases at Maxwell specifically directly from 3M and long-time supplies by 3M to the Defense Logistics Administration. So this is not something we're trying to hide the ball or be clever. I mean, you know, there definitely was 3M manufactured PFAS at Maxwell. And then as to the leaching, if you look at sort of 26, 27, and 28, we have the inspection report to back up our clear allegations. We have the City of Montgomery to complaint to back them up. And then we have something on one of the plaintiff's lawyer's own website. So I think we have more than enough.
Okay, very well. All right, you've got 3 minutes remaining. Ms. Gross, let's hear from you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Anna Green Cross for
I'm sorry, it's Gross on my sheet. I'm so sorry, Cross.
So
sorry.
3M's effort to remove Pine Hills state court claims to federal court fail for many of the reasons that the court won't be surprised to learn that I disagree with my friend across the aisle on almost every of the factual points that were addressed by the court this morning. The key difference here, though, in why the Chevron case doesn't change, and I'm not going to try the Parrish Chevron. Why that case doesn't change the analysis here, even if we're softening a causal nexus and we don't have that anymore. Even with the Chevron's for or related to close relationship language, 3M doesn't make it here. 3M doesn't make it here at all. Now, the concession from my friend on the other side, well, yeah, sure, of course, you know, paragraph 2, paragraph 12, paragraph 33, paragraph 44, none of those paragraphs make the close connection, the actual facts that would make 3M's removal be of these state court claims.
Can I ask you a question? When you say close connection, I guess I read Plaquemines, and I'm just going to keep saying Plaquemines because when I say Chevron, I think about some other Chevron case. So Plaquemines, the language that I'm reading is like not tenuous, remote, or peripheral. That sounds, I don't know, pretty loosey-goosey.
It is a lower standard. It's not causal, certainly. And I'm looking at that same language, too, on page 9 of that opinion. But I want to compare what Chevron considered a close connection compared to what we have here. Now, in Chevron, and you'll forgive me if I stick with Chevron.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
In that case, that was actually Chevron's third attempt to remove that case into federal court. And it wasn't until the disclosure of a plaintiff's expert report that the close connection was able to be made. It wasn't just the defendant saying, and in that case, they admitted that they had dumped, you know, billions of gallons of contaminant into Louisiana's marshes. So they had a much direct, while my friend might have said this morning, that, well, yeah, sure, we supplied it to Maxwell. That's nowhere in this record. That's a new concession. I don't know that it is as gasp-worthy as the Illinois concession that was described a little bit ago, but that's new this morning. But in Chevron, it was the plaintiff's expert report that connected the claims that the plaintiffs were making to the federal work that the defendant maintained was the basis for removal. You just don't have that here. That opinion referenced the expert report, I think, 4 or 5 times. It described its contents. It's not enough for Chevron in that case to have said, yeah, we understand that you want to disclaim our, in that it wasn't, it was a timeline distinction, whether there was a post-war or pre-World War II production of avgas, that was the dispositive issue for whether the for or related to prong could be met. But in that case, it wasn't until there was a plaintiff's report that connected that theory of the defense to the plaintiff's claims. I'm like, okay, well, that's close enough. That's a close relationship. Here's what you don't have here, though. Nowhere in this record has 3M, before this morning, made an admission that they actually supplied the chemical to Maxwell. Their briefing and their facts that they allege that they're trying to use to support this close relationship, let me put it this way.
Well, they say they supplied the chemical to the government, right? But you're saying they don't allege that it was supplied to Maxwell?
Correct. That is correct, Judge Wilson.
But they do allege that it was supplied to the government and the government used it at Maxwell, right?
Not that directly, Judge Kidd. They don't say that. They say 3M and other producers supplied this AFFF, and AFFF was used at Maxwell.
It feels like we're slicing the bologna awfully thin.
That's a threshold issue, but let me phrase it like this. The defendant's position right now is that a chemical that they may or may not have provided to Maxwell could have migrated its way to the Alabama River. And it's possible that that migration made it down to Pine Hill's drinking source, the source of Pine Hill's drinking water.
Why isn't that enough, though, if it's possible? And that's their theory of removal, that it's possible. And if it's true, then there's going to need to be a disaggregation or an apportionment, and that should be done by a federal judge rather than by a state judge.
Okay. Two reasons why I think that's not the accurate read. First, it's not enough for them to allege it. They have to have some competent evidence.
They have a report. They got a report.
They got a report that says that Maxwell soil had AFFF. They do not have a report that says that contamination went anywhere outside the base. In fact, that same report says that it is unlikely in that report's assessment that the AFFF on Maxwell made its way anywhere outside the confines of the base. I'll agree. If the defense in this case, like Chevron, had a report saying, I think it was at Maxwell, I think it's made its way to the river, I think did make its way to Pine River's water source, I think that's a much closer case. But now you have,
all they need is it could have. There's a possibility. And then the person who's going to have to resolve that should be in federal court rather than state court. I think that's their argument.
And I think, Judge Wilson, that does not work because they haven't shown that by any competent evidence. They said it, they haven't shown.
Maybe this is the dumbest question of all time, but why do they have an evidentiary burden at a removal stage where the rule refers to a short and plain statement just like Rule 8 does?
I don't think that's a stupid question at all. I would never say so. But the defendant or the party trying to remove always has a burden, and it's by a preponderance, and these facts are contested. I mean, just like in Meadows, this court identified there needs to be competent evidence of that. Now, it doesn't have to be a full-throated beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, no one's suggesting that, but it's a preponderance standard. It has to be fact.
Why isn't it just plausibility like Twickball?
It would be inconsistent with this course, and honestly, Chevron, for there to be a standard so low that the defendant just has to articulate a thought as opposed to establish plausible facts that would support their theory.
I mean, that's what we require of plaintiffs to file in federal court, right?
Plaintiffs have to file. It needs to be a well-pled complaint, but to remove there is a burden, and it's a preponderance. Yeah, I think the courts in Chevron's reliance on that plaintiff's report, let me reiterate, Chevron tried to remove that case twice before, and it wasn't until the report was produced in discovery that effort got off the ground, that it was successful, because then it wasn't just the defendant articulating a theory.
Can I ask you dumb question number two? And it's not you saying it's dumb, it's me saying it's dumb. Where does this preponderance thing come from? Have we said that?
We have said that.
The 11th,
Leonard,
I mean.
Yes, okay. Yes, sir. And Leonard is quoted in our brief. There is a standard. It's it is by preponderance, and it applies to the party seeking removal.
But it doesn't presumably, surely at the removal stage, we don't mean like a preponderance in the sort of fact-finding kind of way, right? Pleading, to plead something by a preponderance almost makes no sense. It's like incoherent. So like, I mean, you might plead something that's speculative or conjectural, not good enough. Plead something that's plausible, I thought we would say good enough.
That has not been how the cases, including in the Fourth and First Circuit, have worked. You know, I'll take the main case, for example, in the First Circuit. In that instance, again, the 3M attempted to remove several times, and it wasn't until discovery was produced that demonstrated there was a commingling of the chemicals in some of the locations. It wasn't until there was some fact, not just the theory. I guess that's the distinction that I'm looking to draw. It wasn't just a theory that was written down. It was facts that were supported. It doesn't have to be undisputed facts. It doesn't have to be facts that everyone's agreed with, but it has to be some sort of fact, and that's.
But the district court is required, I think we've said, is required to credit the defendant's theory of removal, even if it's not, turns out not to be correct.
I think it was in Meadows that this court identified or clarified that the theory that you need to credit is a legal one. You don't have to, and certainly that's true. I don't dispute that. But while the court may have to credit the removing party's legal theory, I don't think it's required that you indulge a fiction or draw inferences from facts that the defendant themselves have not pled and not established. Before we get too far, Judge Wilson, I was interested in your question to my friend about in the First Circuit case. I was thinking of another question that was posed during that argument. And the question was, and I think this is the big distinction between any of the Fourth or First or even the Seventh or Ninth Circuits, those cases relied on a theory from the state about statewide contamination. 3M's defending these cases in the same way, but the allegations here are so narrow and so more specifically tailored geographically than any of those cases. I think that is distinguishable and frankly dispositive in this case. 3M is alleged, or Pine Hill is maintaining that there was a contamination of a specific waterway from specific and geographically identified locations. It's very narrow. Compare that to what Maine and South Carolina and Maryland were trying to do. They had two parallel tracks of litigation that alleged statewide contamination. It was ubiquitous, I think, was the language used in one of those cases. They alleged the same water and soil and sediment and wildlife was contaminated with both the AFFF, the military chemical, and the non-military chemical, the PFAS. And what ultimately then the for or related to prong was satisfied because, well, there's some commingling between all those things. And there you can't segregate. That's, Judge Wilson, like the apportionment. How are we going to figure out what is AFFF? What's the military stuff made for the government? What's the PFAS was made for commercial use? Someone's going to have to figure that out. You've alleged the same contamination of all the same locations and resources. That's something that should all be together. This is very, very different. It's very different. It's different because there will be no apportionment of this. Alabama's joint and several liability, that's not what we have to show. To show here that to meet our burden, what we've got to show is that the commercial PFAS that 3M sold to these paper mills contained a certain amount of PFAS, that was discharged through the wastewater into the Alabama River, that wastewater made its way to the Pine Hill drinking source or drinking water. It was contaminated when it did that, and that it exceeded the regulatory threshold. Whether there's AFFF or any other chemical in the water, that doesn't matter for our burden of proof. No one's going to have to figure out, well, how much was this military grade and how much was the commercial. That's not our burden of proof here.
So how would that actually work out at the trial? The trial judge would have to enter a motion in limine to exclude any evidence of AFFF?
Well, I think that's getting far down the road. And I also think that's kind of, I see I'm running out of time, but I did want to address why I think this kind of goes hand in hand with why on an alternative ground, there's no colorable federal defense here. It just doesn't matter for causation purposes. There's no federal defense component to 3M's allegation here to their defense, because whether there was AFFF in the water too, doesn't matter. It does not matter. It's not something we need to establish. It's not something we need to exclude. And it's not something that the circumstances where...
Not even if it's their defense, it would be their defense that, well, maybe the contamination resulted from AFFF?
If their defense is, well, maybe there was contamination from anything else, that doesn't lessen our burden to establish that the chemicals that we say, and I think that's the power of the disclaiming or the limited language here.
But you still get back to the need to, if that's their defense, you're still gonna have to sort that out. The court's gonna have to sort that out, right?
I don't think so, because it's just not relevant to the burden of proof that we have. That's just a causation issue.
But causation is an element of your claim, right?
Well, sure it is, but it's one that the state court can adjudicate without there being a federal component to it. I see I'm running out of time. I'm over my time. I don't want to...
Well, make sure you finish. Make sure that Judges Kidd and Wilson have gotten answers to their questions. Judge Kidd?
Nothing else for me.
Okay. Okay. Very well. Thank you so much. All right, Mr. Clement, you've got 3 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a couple of points in rebuttal. The one thing you didn't hear from my friend, did an excellent argument, but you did not hear a not one morsel disclaimer. So I think you can't really decide this case without creating a circuit split if you decided against us. If she'd given the not one morsel disclaimer, then you might have a circuit split either way. But you did not hear that. So just two other points in rebuttal. I mean, one is, the competent evidence standard versus the plausible allegations. I think where my friend is getting the competent evidence standard or competent proof standard is from the Meadows case. But there is a critical difference between removal in the criminal case versus removal in the civil context. There's one provision that substantively provides for removal in both contexts, but there are different statutory provisions for the procedures that govern removal in a civil case versus a criminal case. In the criminal case, it's 28 U.S.C. 1455, and one of the critical differences is that 1455 requires the district court to immediately hold an evidentiary hearing. And that's where I think the competent proof comes in, why there's like a heightened burden in the criminal context, which also makes sense as a practical matter. If you think about it, a state criminal prosecution in federal court is a huge anomaly and can only occur under federal officer removal. Whereas a civil case that based on state law in federal court happens every day. So I think that difference is why the competent evidence standard is the law in a criminal case, but not in a civil case. And if there are any doubt about that, I think the Chevron or Plaquemines case removes it. If you look at page 9 of the opinion, the court, now it's quoting one of its previous precedents, but it flat out says in the parenthetical, quote, we credit plausible factual allegations by the removing party. So I think it's crystal clear, black letter law, that at this stage of the case, what we need are plausible allegations. The only other thing I wanted to say is, my friend talks about the kind of like Chevron was only successful in removing the third time around. There's just a couple of points to contextualize that. First of all, given what happened to the Fifth Circuit and being unanimously removed from the Supreme Court, I don't know that I draw a huge inference from Chevron's lack of success in its first couple of removal efforts there. But more importantly, I think, the affidavit that sort of gave rise to the successful ultimate removal the third time around, I mean, that wasn't something the defendants came up with to carry their burden or something. That was the plaintiff's expert report, which made clear for the first time that, yes, the plaintiffs really are going after World War II. But here, I think the complaint itself, because of what they're asking for, and in particular, the remediation of the water supply, and there's just no way to do that without letting us invoke our defense. And when we invoke our defense, we get into these allocation issues, and those should be done in federal court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, very well. Thank you both. The case is